Sorry, I'd like to start by acknowledging the rest of our storage analytics group at Google. As Bianca said, there's 8 co-authors, and we're lucky enough to have Daniel Ford as well here with us at OSDI this week. I'd like to set the stage for this work by reviewing what we mean by globally distributed storage systems. The building blocks are commodity servers, which are organized into racks, which are then interconnected into clusters. As we increase the scale, we increase the number of faults that we have to deal with to impact availability at each of these levels. On the individual servers, we're interested in component failures, such as CPUs, DRAM, and disks. As we move to the racks, we have to contend with shared networking and power. And as we move to the cluster level, we have to deal again with cluster interconnects, as well as the automated management systems that take care of upgrades and repairs. This is a picture of one of Google's data centers about 400 miles south of us in Oregon. In addition to the failures inside the data center that I described on the last slide, we've also got to contend with snowstorms, fiber cuts, and even the occasional drunken hunter using our fiber and power infrastructure for target practice. On the software side, we're talking about 200-plus clusters of GFS-like storage cells. These are comprised of many thousands of nodes, and they can be file systems up to 75 petabytes or so in size, dealing with thousands of concurrent clients. So given that we run Bigtable and other higher-level storage systems on top of GFS, which is in turn on top of Linux and writing to local disk drives, there's a couple of motivating questions that come up about the availability and statistical properties of the failures that we observe at each of these levels in the storage stack. For example, how available is our data? What are the primary causes of unavailability? And how can we tune and design better storage systems to handle the actual failures that we're observing? So for the next few slides, I'm going to present some data that we've gathered over the last year from a collection of several dozen of the main storage infrastructure at Google. This first plot just shows the CDF of unavailability event durations that we see for individual servers within Google data centers. We define unavailability period as a period of time during which we're not able to contact the server through our monitoring infrastructure for any reason. So one of the interesting things to point out with this fleet-wide average is that you see that the 95th percentile is right around 15 minutes. And what does that say? That tells us that most of the actual unavailability causes that we see in Google data centers are very transient in nature. These are less than 15 minutes on average. The cluster-wide aggregate from the fleet-wide aggregate from the last slide is interesting, but we'd really like to tease this apart into individual failure causes. And so this next slide shows this same data, but broken apart only for the node restarts. And by node restart, I'm describing an event where the GFS chunk server process restarts, but the machine itself stays up. And in this case, the events are even more transitory, in that the median here, you can see, is about 60 seconds in duration. This will happen, for example, it could happen for a software bug, but more likely it could be a planned restart of the application, a flag change or something, which is going to be happening many times every day at scale. The next type of calls I'd like to describe is simply the planned reboots, and this may be because of a kernel upgrade or other calls where we need to actually reboot the physical machine. And the average that we observe over the year is closer to 10 minutes in this case. And finally, the third cause I'd like to highlight here is unplanned reboots. In this case, we've got a much longer period of unavailability, and this would be the case for something like a kernel crash, for example. So in addition to measuring the statistical properties of different failure causes, we're also interested in understanding how correlated these events are. We define a failure burst as a maximal sequence of node failures such that each one occurs within a time window of the previous one. Now, based on some of the practicalities of our monitoring infrastructure, we're using a window of 2 minutes, which works out quite well in practice for our setup. The figure at the bottom of the slides illustrates a little bit of what we mean by a failure burst definition, using the example of 7 failures that are grouped into 2 distinct failure bursts over a time of 30 minutes. And so each rectangle on the y-axis represents a separate unique server, and the x-axis is time. So you can see that the first 5 servers all fail within quick succession of each other, and those are grouped together in a burst, and then we have a pause exceeding our time window, and then another couple of failures. Those are grouped into the second failure burst. We've looked at a number of clustering heuristics, and despite the simplicity, this one actually works quite well in practice for our needs. And using this definition, we find that 37% of all the failures are part of a burst of at least two nodes. And this number has been quite consistent over the last year since we first started tracking it. So these types of failure bursts will have a lot of different characteristics. For example, they'll differ in size, they'll differ in root cause, and they'll also differ in the speed at which they grow. So I wanted to kind of give another example of how these failure bursts differ by showing the growth of a couple of failure bursts in an example cell. Unlike the previous data I've presented so far in this slide deck, this is, again, zooming in at a small time period for a single cell as opposed to being fleet-wide data. And this represents a couple of example failure bursts, but I wanted to highlight just three of them. First of all, each point on this plot represents an individual server failing. The colors represent the groupings between failure bursts. The x-axis is the time that that server failed since the start of the failure burst. And the y-axis is the ordinal within that failure burst. So given those definitions, this black line at the left of this plot, for example, shows a failure burst of 50 servers, because it goes up to 50 on the y-axis, and all of them started within quick succession of each other. This is almost always the case when there's a failure of a shared power domain or something, or network connectivity is lost, or something such that we've instantaneously lost access to all of the 50 servers. And the very mild slope is just an artifact of our monitoring infrastructure not noticing that they were all done until 50 seconds later. On the other hand, we've got the red and the green failure bursts of size about 20. And in this case, these failure bursts have a much slower development speed. This could happen, for example, if it's a rolling reboot of machines where there's some planned staggering between taking down each of the servers, or if there's some other type of cascading failure, but not an immediate failure due to the loss of shared power and networking. So in addition to looking at things like the growth of these failure bursts, we're also interested in something about their spatial locality. Is it the case that we've lost a single rack of machines, or did we lose one machine randomly from a bunch of racks across a data center, or some combination of the two? And so to start investigating this, this is a plot, again, over the full 1 year of fleet-wide data, of looking at all of the failure bursts we've seen and characterizing them by, A, the number of racks that are affected by that failure burst, which is the x-axis, and B, the number of nodes which were affected, which is the y-axis. The size of each bubble then represents the number of times that we observed a failure burst with those two characteristics in the past year. So there's a couple of things I want to point out about this slide. First of all, on the 45-degree line, you see the anti-correlated burst. So this is to say these are bursts with exactly as many nodes affected as racks affected. The second thing I want to point out is that for the smaller bursts, they're not necessarily rack-correlated. But on the other hand, when we look at the larger failure bursts, they're highly rack correlated. And you can see this by the diameter of the circles that are shown, where one or two racks are involved in the failure bursts, but up to about 50 servers are involved. And this is just something we observed many hundreds and thousands of times over the last year of different types of failure bursts with different root causes, but very frequently one or two racks, 50 to 100 machines failing at the same time. So the spatial visualization on the last page is kind of interesting, but it's not very precise. And there's a lot of other ways that we might want to think about the domain correlation of the failure burst that we observe in data centers and how we might use that to design better storage systems. So I first wanted to quantify a little bit about how we talk about the domain correlation of a failure burst. By encoding the failure burst as an n-tuple, we can then come up with a scoring function and talk about probabilities. So to start with, I'd like to give an example based on two failure domains with seven nodes in each failure domain. In the first failure domain, we notice one server failing, and in the second, we've got four. So using this, we define a rack affinity score as the number of ways of choosing two nodes from the burst within the same rack. We can then take that score and look at the probability of a randomly chosen burst of the same size affecting randomly chosen nodes and to see if it will have a higher burst score. Using these definitions, we can add some more rigor to the observations I made from the plot on the last side, which is to say that for bursts of size greater than 10, the rack affinity is greater than 0.7, and for bursts greater than size 40, the rack affinity is greater than 0.9. I've reproduced the slide a little bit to show exactly what I was talking about from the characteristics of the last side, which we've now quantified using this rack affinity score. So what are some of the key findings and takeaways from the fleet-wide studies? First, most unavailability periods are transient. You might want to use this when designing your recovery policies. Second, unavailability durations differ significantly by cause. The mean duration is between 1 and 30 minutes, depending on the cause, and we might also want to use that in the understandings of how we design recovery within distributed storage systems. Third, correlated failures matter. 37% of all of the failures of at least 15 minutes in duration across all Google's data centers are part of a correlated failure burst of at least size 2. And third, the largest correlated failures share common failure domains. This is in some ways obvious, but there's a lot of interesting things that come out of this. For example, we can use the rack affinity score on the last slide not just to identify the obvious cases where a shared piece of infrastructure failed, but also some of the more subtle examples. For example, batches of components are often deployed linearly throughout the data center. So if you get a new batch of components in, say, disk drives with a slightly higher failure rate than some of the others, and then you deploy those across racks in your data center with different batches going into different racks, you may see have some level of rack correlation to your failures, even though it's not the case that everything failed all at once. And so this is an example of how some of these metrics can help us troubleshoot problems in our supply chain or understand what's really happening in our data centers. So with that, I think I'd turn it over to Florentina to describe more about the high-level modeling work we can do based on this fleet-wide data.
Thank you, Mori.
So Mori talked about data about failures and correlated failures in our fleet. And now we'll move a layer higher in the storage stack and talk about distributed storage systems. Data in our cells is stored in stripes. Stripes are made out of chunks, which are fixed-size data in code blocks. Traditionally, storage systems used different data redundancy schemes to deal with failures, such as replications and erasure encodings, such as Reed-Solomon. So in terms of notation, we use R equals N to talk about replication. And in this situation, we have a strap that's made up of N chunks. And if a chunk becomes unavailable, then it can be reconstructed from any of the remaining ones that are still part of the stripe. For Reed-Solomon, we use the notation RSN, M, where we use N to talk about data chunks, and we use M to talk about code chunks. When a chunk becomes unavailable, then it can be reconstructed from any of the remaining N chunks. And if more than M chunks become unavailable, then the stripes becomes unavailable. So we said that the chunk is unavailable if the node that the chunk is on becomes unavailable. And in case of replication, if a stripe is unavailable, if none of the chunks, part of it, are available. So now with this layout of data in a stripe, there come options of how to actually do placement of chunks in a cell. So there is opportunity to study how the availability is affected by layout of data and different encoding schemes. So we wanted to see if it pays off to be aware of the failure domains in our placement. So more specifically, we focused on rack-aware placement. And when we do rack-aware placement, it means that we place each chunk in a stripe on a different rack. So we have a lot of data in this graph, but mainly we have three columns, and we have a column for each failure burst sizes that we are considering. And we place bursts in this three different categories according to the fraction of the cell that was affected by the burst. The y-axis represents mean time to failure of the stripe in days. Thus, the larger values represent higher availability, more desirable. And each column represents the mean time to failure for that failure burst when you use different data redundancy schemes. And for each size, we have two columns when we have data placement that is rack-aware and when it's not, on the right-hand side and left-hand side. So we see that for small and medium bursts and large encodings, the magnitude of mean time to failure increases with 3, typically, with rack-aware placement, while for a large burst, there isn't such a big difference. So this type of study has been done with a combination of dynamic programming and combinatorics, and it was interesting to gather these insights, but actually we wanted to go even further investigating design choices in our system. More specifically, we wanted to see if we can see what's the effect of different recovery times, these failure rates, and so on. And we do this type of analysis by using a Markov model. Before I should talk in a bit more detail about it, I want to highlight a number of benefits from using this type of modeling. If we use these models, we can explore changes in the hardware and software that would be difficult to explore otherwise. For example, we can play with different hard disk failure rates. We can also explore large design spaces, such as selecting data redundancy schemes that would be prohibitive to be tested in the production environment because of the large number of choices to be tested. Finally, we can study low availability rates that are otherwise hard to measure. Now, several of the details of the model are presented in the paper, and here I just have a depiction of a simple Markov chain for R equals 2 replication. And the circles represent the states of the model, and the arrows represent transition. A state of the model is the number of available chunks. As an example transition, when a chunk becomes, in the stride becomes unavailable, there is a transition from state 2 to state 1, and then a transition back if there is a chance recovery. So these probabilities that govern the transitions between states are important. And you can imagine that we can set these probabilities by using numbers that we measured in our fleet, or we can use experimental values if you want to test how changes in the parameters of our system will affect the overall data availability. So in the next slides, I will present a number of findings that we made using this model. First, we focused on recovery time. So, and we found that reducing recovery time is effective with few correlated failures. And to give you a couple of data points, if we use Riis-Solomon with the 6.3 encoding with no correlated failures, a 10% reduction in recovery times results in a 19% reduction in unavailability, while if the model does consider correlated failures, a 90% reduction in recovery times, much larger, results in only a 6% reduction in unavailability. Next, we wanted to see if correlation does matter when predicting mean time to failure availability. And the short answer is yes, it matters a lot. But let's see how this is sustained by numbers. So this table has estimations for the stride mean time to failure when we use several data redundancy schemes, with each row representing a different scheme. And the second and the third column represent the estimations for mean time to failure when the model considers correlated failures and when it doesn't. And again, higher mean time to failure values are better. So focusing only on the exponents on the second and third column, you can see that actually ignoring correlation greatly underestimates unavailability, anywhere from 2 to 8 orders of magnitude. Additionally, correlation reduces the benefit of increased data redundancy, as can be seen in the rate of mean time to failure decrease as we advance from the first to last rows in the table. The third finding ties back into the beginning of the presentation when Murray talked about the complex systems we work with. They are made of thousands of nodes, many more disks, and there are several interesting studies that focus on disk failure rates. We wanted to see how the disk failure rates affect the availability in our system. And we found that they do not significantly affect the availability of the system, and node failure rates play a much higher role. And we have numbers here to support this. Finally, moving to a larger geographical scale, we investigated the effect of distributing the data across data centers. So we studied the single versus multi-site replication. And this sounds like a biology-related slide, but we are still talking about availability here. What we considered here, we considered four identical data chunks, either as an R equal 4 replication scheme in one data center or as an R equal 2 by 2 scheme in two data centers, with each data center hosting one R equal 2 replicated stripe. The result is that better availability can be achieved with multi-site replication and same space overhead. And in this example situation, we have an MTTF increase of two orders of magnitude. And intuitively, this increase happens because if we use this multi-state replication scenario, then we cut the probability of having correlated failures. Also, with this second scenario, we introduce an interesting cost trade-off between inter-state recovery bandwidth and higher state replication. again, going back to this I equal 2 by 2 example, we need to provision a recovery bandwidth between the cells of about 6.8 megabytes per day, considering a petabyte of data that needs to that is studied. While if you were to use actually a higher replication scheme of FreeSolomon 6.3, we'll actually need to provision only for 97 kilobytes per day. As a summary, we presented data from our fleet. We showed that understanding distributed storage system availability requires much more than understanding these failure rates. We also showed that understanding correlative failure scenarios is key to understanding and designing for availability. Several of the insights coming from this characterization study have been useful for our design and operation teams. And we have here three examples of those. One of the insights was determining an acceptable rate of successful transfers to battery power for individual machines upon a power failure. The second one was focusing on reducing reboot times because planned kernel updates actually turned out to be a major source of correlative failure. And the third one was to move towards dynamic delay before initiating recoveries based on failure classification and recent history of failures in the cell. With this, open to questions.
Go ahead. Garth Gibson, CMU. The slow climbing curve, the rolling upgrades causing large compound bursts, that thing looked really interesting. The green and the red lines there look really interesting. And if they are something like planned upgrades rolling, you could anticipate them and control the order they go. And my instinct is that might have a really big impact on your overall analysis. Did you look at that at all?
Absolutely. There's a couple of points to that. First of all, we want to take the these systems need to be talking together, and certainly they are to some extent, but that's really key for this sort of thing. So the automated systems that are dealing with these upgrades need to be talking to the GFS masters or the coordinating processes that deal with where the data is placed, and so that they can make additional replicas before the data goes out. And there's all kinds of stuff that you can do with this. Also, we need to do a better job of sort of teasing apart all of the myriad ways that that can cause unavailability. We introduced some sort of coarse level aggregations in some of the earlier plots, but there's so many different systems and tools to do this. We didn't project all that data here, but absolutely we can break this down further by exact cause. For example, the systems that deal with kernel upgrades or something, and list that separately or use, because we know that's going to be a quicker type of unavailability event. Great question.
Stefan Soroyu, Microsoft Research. So I have a question about sort of your graphs with respect to the unavailability. So a lot of the graphs sort of show that, you know, something like 95% of the events actually last, I don't remember, 5 minutes or 15 minutes. I was wondering whether, is it true that most of the time the machines are unavailable actually are because of the long time intervals? In other words, yes, most of the events are actually short failures, but most of the time spent being down is in this long failure. Is that true or not? I'm actually was asking.
Oh, sorry. That's a great question again, and I think we've answered that with the plots that are in the paper. So we've taken, these are just the counts of events and the frequency, and so what we've done is scale that by the size of those events to get the overall contribution to unavailability.
So. Okay, and what's the answer?
So the answer to the question is yes, some of these longer ones absolutely dominate the transient ones. So the transient ones, while dominating the event counts, are minuscule in terms of the unavailability counts because they're so short in duration.
And does the model or these sort of insights apply for those large causes of unavailability?
I'm sorry, what part of the
model? So sort of like you build this model about here's how unavailability sort of works in the system. And it's sort of dominated by this large number of events that are actually small in time. And I was wondering whether that sort of captures sort of the big pain of the system in terms of...
Yeah, that's one of the main challenges, certainly, is because we have these very rare events such as, you know, the drunken hunters that'll, you know, shoot out your fiber infrastructure in the middle of the night, and then the snowplow that comes to get to it can't reach it for 2 days, and, you know, these sorts of very rare but events that will happen for a 10-year history of time. You'll have every imaginable scenario, and so certainly we have some challenges trying to model those, and in our case, we just try to be overly conservative wherever we can because we know they're going to be pretty rare.
Thank you.
Mehul Shah, HP Labs. So I have a question about the modeling part on modeling availability. What I noticed in your graphs is that the schemes that were erasure-coded gave you the highest availability possible. My hunch is they also give you a better cost availability trade-off, a much better cost availability trade-off than the replication schemes. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the cost effectiveness of these schemes? And if the erasure-coded scheme is better by a lot, are you guys using it?
So that's an interesting question. Actually, I had to skip a little bit over some of the insights because we're a little bit of pressure by time to finish the talk in time. So in this graph, actually, we're showing exactly what you were mentioning, that actually the Reed-Solomon, the original codes are as powerful as the replication schemes in terms of dealing with failures. But obviously, they have a better space overhead. So yes, we are considering using Reed-Solomon encodings.
So I guess the follow-on is, what's the drawback, and why didn't you start with the Reed-Solomon coding to begin with?
I certainly. So like for a MapReduce workload or something, it may be the case that you absolutely want more copies of your data that parallel workers can read and write to. So for batch-oriented processing or something, there may be performance reasons why you'd want that. Also, of course, it's a trade-off with recovery bandwidth and things like that. When you lose a Reed-Solomon stripe, you're going to have to read. Here's a slide of like how chunk recovery is going to work, right? This is a backup slide we can present. But in the case of a replicated data, you're going to have to read from one server, one disk drive, to get the data back and write it back out. Whereas with Reed-Solomon, you have to read and recompute in parallel, right? So that's going to be more servers that you're talking to. The tail of that latency curve might be a bit higher for uses like MapReduce.
And then you also have some CPU cost as well, because obviously you have to recompute rather than just copying.
Thanks.
Phil Howard, Portland State University. The first talk this morning, they showed how a single image Linux can scale to at least 48 cores. You guys are sort of going the other way, scaling with smaller systems through clustering and racks and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, if the number of cores per box continues to go up, would that make your reliability better and easier, or more difficult because now you've got a single motherboard failure that can take out more cores? So I wonder if you can comment on that, and if you I don't, this may be outside your area, but power savings and total cost of system going again the way you've gone with clustering versus many core architectures.
There's a lot of interest certainly in the multi-core architectures at Google, and I think that metric we care about. I mean, people think that we use very low, cheap commodity servers, and cheap to us might be a little bit different than what other people are thinking about. And so absolutely, it's the cost per core, per watt, per year, which is what we care about. And so to the extent that those multi-core servers are able to improve in those metrics versus paying for the, you know, separate power supplies and enclosures for smaller cored machines, we actually consider those as perfect examples of something we'd want to use for our GFS cells and things like that.
This type of approach with looking at, you know, how numbers are in the fleet and then following up with modeling and seeing how tweaking certain values of the system, follows up with, you know, changes in data availability at the storage level. It's, you know, this is exactly why to do this type of modeling to answer, you know, the type of questions that you are putting. So basically you are saying that you might have a larger failure domain that's represented by a node, and how will this affect the higher level storage availability. So that's, we are interested in answering those questions.
It's not just cores, it comes up with disks as well, right? Given the failure rates of power supplies and so on, should you have 10 disks per machine? Should you have 2 disks? Should you have 40 disks per machine? And I think you get the exact same questions you have with looking at cores. You have cost and what implications, but also the fact that when you have a failure, the recovery is going to involve so much more data and so on. And so, yeah, we've been sharing this with a lot of internal teams to decide how exactly we want our next generation data centers to look like.
Any speculative guesses?
I'm not prepared to make any here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.